Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon, and thank you for joining this session of Conference of World Affairs. Today is Friday, April 12th. It's 1:30 p.m., and this is panel number 4407, Pass the Turing Test, the Future of Artificial Intelligence. My name is Tim O'Shea. I'll be your moderator this afternoon. We will have some time at the end of the session for question and answer, and we'll walk you through that process when the time comes. So certainly look for note cards or register your questions in the app as we begin our discussion. One brief announcement, too, for folks that are planning the rest of their afternoon into the evening. Unfortunately, due to some unpleasant weather conditions, the party that was scheduled for today at 4:30 on the Hill has been canceled. There are several of the restaurants that will be offering extended happy hour and other discounts to make up for the absence of that event. So hopefully you can all adjust and continue to enjoy your time here today. Well, welcome. Thank you again for being here. I'd like to begin with a brief introduction to our panel as we dive into the topic of where we're finding ourselves today with the rise of not just artificial intelligence, but really the developments of the last 60-plus years in this space. This isn't going to be too much of a history lesson as much as it is going to be talking about the topic and reflecting on it through a few different lenses. And quite often, I think we think about the future of technology with just strictly risk and benefit, and it's worth exploring opportunities as well as some of the costs that may be associated with that. And I think this panel will offer a great degree of insight for all of us. Starting from our far left at the end of the table, is William Hertley. William is a writer, a web strategist, and a programmer. And he has an award-winning Singularity series, and his books are actually quite fascinating in looking at not just the rise of technology, but I think experiences that he recognized as a programmer, peering into the lens of what technology was doing and creating. His new novels, Kill Process and Kill Switch, are techno-thrillers exploring data ownership, privacy, trust, and personal freedom. Next to him is Christopher Horsthief. Christopher is an educator, an organizational theorist, a consultant, and has done a lot in the spaces of language, social network architectures, cultural entropy, and their role in post-crisis network fragmentation and alignment processes. To my left is Ivan Penn. He's an energy correspondent for the New York Times and president of the Power of Song Incorporated. As a correspondent for the New York Times, Ivan covers energy issues related to the electric grid, renewables, electrification of the transportation sector, and those who regulate the industry. His work covering the recent fires out in California and the role of PG&E has been fantastic, and I highly recommend for all of these gentlemen that you take a look at not only their bios and their program, but their current works and their streams are definitely worth following, liking, and adding to your regular news and stream feeds. Diving into the topic of artificial intelligence and where we find ourselves, in 1950, Alan Turing began his paper titled Computing Machinery and Intelligence with this premise, and I quote, "I propose to consider the question, can machines think?" Already established as a brilliant, accomplished mathematician, computer scientist, cryptanalyst, logician, and philosopher, Turing turned his attention toward the future and where we find ourselves today. The Turing test, for those of you that aren't familiar, was inspired by a party game popular at the time, known as the Imitation Game, in which a man and a woman go into separate rooms and guests try to tell them apart by writing a series of questions and reading the typewritten answers sent back, effectively determining, is this the person that I think it is behind door number one or door number two? In his writing, Turing pondered, what will happen when a machine takes part of a player in this game? And can that machine convince us that it's not a machine at all, but one of us? And I think more and more these days, as we call in to work with our various service providers or sign online to different forms, we're finding more and more interactions that may not be with a human being on the other side, and many decisions that are being made for us that impact our lives and the outcomes of our world may not involve a human hand or mind at all. I'd like to start with an opportunity for our panelists to delve into this topic, provide their thoughts, and William, I'll hand off to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, all of you, for being here. Just out of curiosity, who was here in the last panel on AI? So a few folks, okay. Wanted to be careful, I was going to repeat everything I said. So I've been writing about artificial intelligence from a fictional perspective for a while, but my goal is to explore more complex issues than what was typically explored in the past in science fiction. So science fiction looked at is the automated machines going to kill us or not? Are they alive or not? Do they have rights or not? But I think it's a lot more complex and nuanced than that. And that's what I've been exploring in my fiction for the last 10 years. As a precursor to this conversation, I want to talk about the fact that there's two different kinds, broadly speaking, of AI. There's what we think of as narrow AI, which is computer algorithms to do single tasks, drive a car, recognize things from an image, play a game of chess. We don't expect to be able to talk to our car. It's not going to become our friend. That kind of stuff is reserved for what's called strong AI or general AI. And so when Turing is talking about will we be able to put a machine in the room and have us believe that it's a person, right? That's talking about strong or general AI. The narrow AI is what we see in the world around us today. It's what affects our feed, what we're reading on Facebook. It's recommendation algorithms for content. And it's what we're probably likely to have for the next 10 to 20 to 30 years. But at some point in time, we're likely to have general AI. We're likely to have AI that will be indistinguishable from us if it chooses to be, or it could be very alien to us, but it's likely to have capabilities on the magnitude of what we have or more. I think I'm going to leave it there, and I'm sure we'll be getting to more questions as we go.
I appreciate that. Thank you, William. Christopher, given the background and expertise that you've been developing in your work, when you think through AI and how you've embraced certain advantages of the network architectures and systems, give us a sense of where you land when you ponder this topic and the possibilities and risks therein.
Sure. Thanks for coming out. For those of you that have seen my other panels, they were all very much art and culture and language and indigenous. And this is the other part of the thing that I get to do, which is kind of the math, the science, the networks, that part. They're both, I think, complementary aspects of resilience. For myself, my background is in collective intelligence, which overlaps with AI in the realm of kind of artificial life. At what point do people use mechanical architectures, computers, networks, to kind of instantiate what looks like or is indistinguishable from the kind of life-like interactions and decision-makings that people make when they're together? So we started, in particular, in my community, which is the Donata community. We're a small linguistic isolate. At the confluence of southern Alberta, that little tip of BC, north Idaho, that corner of Washington, and western Montana. So two countries, two provinces, three states, and everything's a disaster. Communication, problem solving, applying for grants, paying for people that are from another country or another state or province. So we started trying to ask the question, can we use our network tools to solve problems indistinguishably from if we were all in the same room doing it? So the idea that the Turing test came from this game where you have to ask questions of humans to try and figure out if it's the right human, and then AI has kind of went in this direction with the Turing test. Are the answers you're getting from a computer or a human? We always go back to that human part of it. What kind of preferences or histories or backgrounds or diversities are causing those decision-making agents, whether they are economic beings making decisions about preferences or strategies? Is it somebody trying to save their culture, choosing which part of the language to share? Is it a storyteller that has some underlying preference that is being represented in those interactions? For me, the idea is, be really careful with the barriers of entry to the networks that you have. The more you raise those, you're going to be missing out on some people or some human qualities that might end up with computers, given a CEO's set of profit margins that are now going to make the decisions about who gets air or water or firefighting services or medical care. So how do you make sure that there are people in a very wide collection of people, very much like the wisdom of the crowds, whose values are instantiated in those kinds of artificial life scenarios. If there's a board or a panel or a network that's deciding what cancer treatment you will get, or how much power you will be allotted, or how much square footage to grow crops, whose decisions are those, and whose decisions get to be a part of them?
Fantastic. There's a few seeds of thought that I'd like to revisit in a few moments, Christopher. But I think this is a great time, since you did touch on some of the corporate aspects, for Ivan to introduce us a bit to some of his work as a journalist and how he's been understanding some of the evolving opportunities, risks, and challenges when we consider machine learning, data-driven aspects of our economy, certainly our companies, and the impacts to the communities that they touch.
Sure, and thank you. It's good to be with you this afternoon. As has been mentioned, I am the energy correspondent for the New York Times. On the side of the energy coin that covers the power grid, I have a colleague in Houston who covers oil, natural gas, and coal. What I want to sort of introduce into the conversation is a look at AI from the side of benefits to the consumer. Typically, one of the concerns is the threat to the consumer, but coming from the position where I sit as an energy reporter, particularly when you look at the current stories that I've been writing about Pacific Gas and Electric and the wildfire, particularly last year, that destroyed the community of Paradise, cost the lives of 85 people, and we're looking at billions of dollars in property losses in addition to those fatalities. Everything points to a tower that was 100 years old, a tower that PG&E, by its own standards, should have done something with at least 25 years before the wildfire last year. Its own standards say the useful life of a tower is 75 years. So at 100 years old, this was a quarter century past its useful life. And the question is, could there have been something in place to ensure that we don't have old infrastructure that is at risk of failure and threaten our lives as consumers? And so there's an area where one would offer that there's potential for AI to step in and give us an analysis of our grid system, where human failure has been devastating. There's no question that there is a big concern about still what the inputs would be, who they were coming from. But there's a potential for some protections there. Another quick example is that I received a call from a woman in the desert, from a community where the members of that community were low-income, disadvantaged. This particular woman was a retired senior on a fixed income and a low fixed income. And the utility had sent letters to the community, said, we're going to be doing a maintenance outage at on some of our infrastructure, and you need to leave your home for a week and go live somewhere else until the maintenance outage is completed. So she called me, and she said, I can't move. I don't have any money to go away for a week. So I called the utility and said, hey, guys, what's going on? She calls me back sometime later and says, hey, they canceled the maintenance outage. And I was like, well, yeah, I don't think that knowing that reporters knew that they were cutting off the power to disadvantaged people in the desert during, I forgot to mention, it was during the summertime in the desert. AI could more efficiently look at the infrastructure and say, when is a good time, given all of the inputs, to do a maintenance outage, and not in the middle of summer affecting the lives of our vulnerable citizens. And then finally, would offer this. In an age where now we can put solar panels on our rooftops and a battery in our garage, you have places in Europe, Germany in particular, where you have peer-to-peer energy sharing. AI could assist us, as we're not doing so much of that here in the United States, but assist us with being able to do more peer-to-peer energy sharing. Not a fan of the utility companies, but this could be a benefit to consumers. So there are some benefits of AI and machine learning that could assist on the consumer side, both in health, safety, and protections, as well as being able to assist the consumer on the economic side.
Thank you. William, I'd like to introduce a bit of your work back into the dialogue, and I appreciate that both Christopher and Ivan have focused on a certain human aspect to the role of this technology and the potential for its benefit, but certainly well aware of the potential technical pitfalls, both of not properly utilizing as well as perhaps misutilizing by the very design and nature of what some of the underlying motivations may be. In your, I think, 2017 piece on your blog, you talked about some of the risks and benefits. And I think, certainly as a young science fiction reader, I was enamored by the idea of AI, but popular media, I think, has led us down the path of recognizing it as a significant threat. And you've identified some of the realities of threat and benefit. And I'd like to introduce some of your awarenesses there for the benefit of the audience and start to weave back into some of these potential benefits and ways that we can re-involve the human side, particularly as this technology is well past the Turing test, as I'm sure you'll enlighten us.
Sure. I guess I'll talk about two different things. So, let's talk about self-driving cars for a minute. Self-driving cars clearly within the realm of AI. 3,000 people die every day in automotive accidents. That's a pretty big number, and that number may not go to zero, but self-driving cars would take us a long percentage of the way towards zero. It would probably reduce the severity of accidents even when they are inevitable. So that's a pretty tremendous benefit from self-driving cars, which is driven by AI. There's a tremendous efficiency that you can get, a resource efficiency. If you put an AI driving a car, you're going to get better gas mileage or electrical consumption. You're going to get better resource utilization in the vehicle itself. You don't need as many cars on the road if those cars are being shared. We already see that from the car sharing economy. You can reduce the amount of space that you use for parking, which then increases your space utilization in cities. So there's just a whole slew of benefits that you could get out of this one thing, self-driving cars. On the other hand, 5% of all of the jobs in the United States are related to driving vehicles of one type or another. So 10 years from now, 15 years from now, those jobs will be gone. And that's a huge swath of America to be put out of work. And one of the challenges is there's been other technological innovations that have eliminated jobs, like the rise of the invention of the cotton gin. People were afraid of how that was going to affect employment. But when that technology came along, then other things were invented that created new kinds of jobs. So the history of technological innovation hasn't caused mass unemployment. But what's different about AI is just its spread. It can be applied to so many different domains. There's so many different kinds of jobs that may be obsoleted at the same time. So whether you're a bank teller or working in a fast food restaurant or driving a car, tons of these kinds of things can all be obsoleted at the same time, and that's going to cause mass unemployment on a level we haven't seen. So that's one of the minus sides. But then you also have, what happens when something just goes wrong with the infrastructure? What if all the cars are self-driving cars and they don't have a gas pedal and a steering wheel anymore, and one morning the technology doesn't work for whatever reason? Maybe there's been a virus, maybe there's been a terrorist attack, and something's disabled it, and now we don't have the infrastructure that we depend upon for life, right? It's not just about you driving to the grocery store, it's about how do the goods get to the grocery store in the first place? Well, they're going to get there on automated trucks, right? And if those trucks don't show up, there's not that much food at the grocery store. So there are some existential risks to these kinds of things. So scale risk. Oh, and then we also have the chance for certain malevolent actors to get involved, right? If you have a self-driving car, you have the potential for a hacker to take advantage of that. And we've already seen that with devices, right? In the past, we had issues where hackers would take advantage of somebody's, they would penetrate somebody's computer and spy on what they were writing. But that was like the extent of what they could see, is what you did on your computer. But if someone, if a hacker gets access to your phone, they can know everything that you're talking about, both when you're in a phone call, but just when you're in the vicinity of your phone. They know where you're going. They know, kind of everything about you, right? And that takes it to a whole new scale. And we see that in the world today, where people are being blackmailed and harassed by their phones. And it just isn't on that big of a scale, but it's obviously a terrible thing to the people that it happens to. We're going to see more of those kinds of things with AI in the future. So I've talked a lot about the narrow AI. As we get the strong AI, we get a whole other set of questions, right? The benefits and the risks kind of go through the roof, right? Strong AI can solve social problems that we have on a scale that we can't even imagine, right? We could be done with environmental problems in 25 years, but the AI might decide that it doesn't like us and kill us all, right? So both the scale of both the solution and the problem gets even greater.
Thank you. And a few of the points that you've touched on have me thinking a bit more about your work, Christopher, and you focused on the preservation of identity through complex network architectures and a demonstration of complex emergent resilience. When we think about collective intelligence and how that how that overlaps with our increasing desire to create artificial life or mimicry of our real world in a digital space, and as I've deemed it, kind of connected disconnectedness of plugging into technology, how have you seen strengths emerge where the human consistency is maintained, and that we're not creating a monoculture of those with access to technology so that we're actually serving a greater good with these tools as opposed to continuing to isolate and fragment the human aspects?
Well, I work with a community that's been through a very extended process of collective trauma, where our children were taken away for between 4 and 8 generations, where we were not allowed to speak our language, pray the way our people had done since, well, for 13,000 years, or since animals were the people, like you talk to our old ladies. And we started to become very fearful of a lot of the tools around us, a lot of these new great tools that might be available to us. We had a little bit of the distrust syndrome, because every tool that was brought to us was used to take our kids away, take our language away, take our land away, take our spirituality away, take away our ability to have conversations with people. So we had a hard time differentiating between tools that were new and useful and tools that were these kinds of tools of dispossession. So when I started doing work, I put together a social network. I stole a lot of great ideas from Facebook and some other coders. And we put together a network based on our language, where you could get a profile and have friendships. You could upload media. You could ask questions. And the primary research question was, will people see this as a threat and shut down? Or will people do the same thing that those 12-year-old boys jacked up on Mountain Dew playing whatever video game do, where they can say and do anything because they're not immediately in front of someone? And the first time we pulled the data, we've got these wonderful scale-free distributions, high clustering, low geodesics, all those things that are beautiful about collectively intelligent problem-solving systems. But more importantly, we saw people that couldn't talk about things in real life, like, I never met my grandfather, but I have pictures of him, and I'm afraid to introduce myself to him. We saw people that would ask those questions and post that picture. And instead of people being ugly to them or shutting them down, we actually saw people that original person didn't even know that would post things like, hey, I really appreciate that you did that. Let me tell you a little bit about what I know about your grandfather. Your grandfather's name in English was so-and-so, and this was his family. So you're connected to more people than you realize, even if you don't always feel like you can go and talk to them in person. What was even more beautiful after that, when you get more than kind of one zone away from that person, other people would say, not only was that his English name, this was his Kutunaha name. This is where he was from, and this is the oral history that goes with it. And then someone else would log on and say, I know where that picture was taken. That was taken at the old barn at Kispanok, and that's where people would meet every week, and there was this great exchange of ideas. So we found people that, number one, were probably a little bit nervous about interacting with people, but didn't have that whole community of people looking back at them through very skeptical eyes. They were able to access this vast amount of information and encode it in such a way that people were built up. So when I talk about the instantiation of human problem-solving systems and technologically mediated structures or artificial life, we saw people reaching out and bringing people back into the community. People that had been dismembered in the sense they'd been taken away from community were being remembered in the sense that they were tied back into it and connected. They were never the same again on that network. And really, when they would go into the community, they were no longer the same because now they knew there's cousins of mine here. There's people that I know there. There are all these people that I didn't know before, and each one of them has something to offer. You can't trust all of them because there's always someone that wants to borrow money or something. But there are all of these people, if you were to go up and say, hey, I talked to you online and we talked about this idea or that idea, you would see that they'd really light up. And they'd, oh, that was really good. I'm glad I got to meet you in person. That network, which was called Wupanik Natanik, which is our way of saying technology in our language, or literally new times, we kind of closed that network down because Facebook is on everybody's phone and everyone's computer and tablet everywhere. And now we have several problem-solving groups, one based on our language, one based on politics, one based on social issues, where people can reach out and have this kind of artificial life situation where the underlying ideas and preferences and story and those old deep philosophical structures are other people. But they're people that you wouldn't see on an everyday basis, but you can now interact with and solve problems the same way. And by solving problems, everything from buying arts and crafts to learning new stories or parts of the language to communicating about political or legal ideals or something like that.
Thank you. And building on those thoughts, William, we're building AI in this very room. We're all data points on these various structures, and based on some of the things that Christopher has shared, we're all members of this experiment. Well past the Turing test, we're actually in the petri dish of these evolving technologies. And I'm curious to understand, as the bulk of this work is being done by corporations with profit motives, as you're seeing this emergence occur, where are those opportunities for more diversity of human input? And are we in a position where we can perhaps tip some of that development? Because we are really teaching these systems, are we not? And in so doing, we're crystallizing some of our humanity into a more digital construct, which will then be representative of our ethics, our values, our beliefs and concerns. How have you seen that emerge? And then I'd like to loop back to Ivan for some ideas around some of that corporate accountability.
Yeah, that's a big question. It's like that story brings out to me like the very best that technology can offer us. The very best that technology can offer us is to make us be more human and connect on deep, meaningful levels. And when technology does that, right, the results are amazing and transformational. They make a difference in people's lives. I've had countless experiences like that. Like, I've been immersed in online culture since the 1980s. And the characteristics of early online culture is that none of it really was being driven by a corporate profit motive. It was just people getting together, talking about the things that they wanted to talk about, getting together with other like-minded people to have meaningful conversations, to be able to ask the things that they would not ask face-to-face because it was too vulnerable to do so, and enabling those kinds of things. It's like I've been a huge fan of online culture all through the years. Where I feel like it's started to get dysfunctional is in the recent years, where it is increasingly driven by a profit motive. And not all of it in a negative way. The like button came about because they realized that They wanted to basically make it more accessible for people to contribute. And sometimes people didn't feel articulate. They didn't have a sentence to offer. They wanted to be able to do something small. And, well, what's the smallest thing that somebody could do that's still an interaction? You could like something, right? Well, that, so like it stems from a good purpose. But where does that ultimately go? Is it ultimately goes to, you know, people creating these artificial constructed representations of themselves so they can get more likes, to get a short-term dopamine hit? Now we're totally not in the realm of connecting in any kind of a meaningful way. So I'm fairly distrustful of things that are corporate-driven, even though it may start out in a good place, it's not ultimately where it goes. What we need is just more people taking back the technology and figuring out how to create things. From the perspective of artificial intelligence, where I think that's really meaningful is that right now, AI is a really difficult problem. And it requires lots and lots of computing resources. And so that puts it in the realm of just the few big players, right? Google can have really advanced AI. Facebook can have advanced AI. But over time, this is going to become more accessible. It's going to become something that you're going to be able to run sophisticated AI on a single computer. You're going to be able to run AI that you build out of building blocks that are available to anybody, which means that we're going to see a lot more AI driven by individuals and driven by small communities, driven by subcultures. And to me, that's where a lot of the positive things are going to come, not from the corporate stuff.
Thank you. And Ivan, touching back to corporations and some accountability, in your role as a journalist, you certainly faced a bit of change, I think, in how journalism is received and welcomed by certain aspects of our emerging world. But you've been at the forefront of pursuing accountability and recognizing both the benefit of new and emerging tools that could help in the situations that you've covered. But where do you see opportunities to sort of mind the system as we look at the emerging role of AI and machine learning, particularly in the hands of corporations that may be more motivated by profit than they are about protection or safety?
All of it's complex. And it's not, and actually it's not new, it's just more advanced. Napoleon said four hostile newspapers are more to be feared than 1,000 bayonets. So, the concern from public figures is has long been there in regard to journals. On the regulatory end of this, it gets really difficult because you, while on the practical level, you have the concerns of where the technology itself goes. But when you start to, the core element of journalism, follow the money, and how this plays out in our city, state, and federal governments, the ability of corporations to bring to bear enormous amounts of money, lobbyists, lawyers, it continually shapes the whole game, and the consumer is left at a disadvantage. And so even as much as we try to do as journalists to inform the public so that you can make good decisions about the people that you elect and those who are regulating how this all gets shaped, because I mean the things that I was articulating about AI were coming from a consumer standpoint. But beyond just AI, when you look at, I guess the best example is to look at what I cover now. When you go to a regulatory hearing for any utility company, the consumer, the individual consumer, anybody in this room who is not an official advocate for consumers, but just the everyday person, you can't walk into that hearing and participate in the hearing itself. They'll have a segment for you to argue your concerns, but then when it comes down to the actual policy, you become excluded. So, and the players become someone who is a quote-unquote consumer advocate or what they term intervener on behalf of consumers, and those could range from one environmental example, would be Sierra Club might represent the consumers in energy matters. And then you're standing up against the corporate lawyers of the utility company, and the breadth of their financing is you, because they pay those lawyers with the ratepayers' money, and so you know the depth of their pockets go what they have in the bank and also what you have in the bank, and so you put that in the context of AI and what happens on the corporate side of this, it does become a very challenging and difficult issue to deal with. How does the average person benefit from, I mean, because a lot of what has been laid out and even what I was sort of suggesting is on what William described as the narrow AI. How do you control the other pieces? Well, it becomes a focus on what the consumers can and will do in those regulatory hearings before your representatives on the city, state, and federal levels. People are always asking us as journalists, so, well, what can I do? You can email, call your representatives. If you don't like how it's being shaped, then you've got to participate. And you've got to convince your neighbors to participate. Because you're the only ones who really can do, I mean, we can tell you what's going on. Those who have the more technical expertise in a particular area, and especially, I mean, yes, this is there's a lot of critical pieces here about where does this go, the protection of us and our humanity. But then the flip side of that is that we still have the same exact problem when it comes to what the corporations are doing before regulators and before the politicians.
Thank you. And we've got some great questions coming through, and I'd like to start to introduce some of the feedback from the audience for your input. And one area that's bubbled up in our conversation stream is looking at when implementing AI, how do we deal with people's fear and distrust for the technology? And Christopher, my sense is that as you've looked to introduce technology into a diversity of populations, particularly where maybe technology wasn't as prevalent, you've already described some places where fear has been overcome in the process of recognizing that there's an opportunity to approach something, perhaps through a new and meaningful channel. But when we think through these technologies, what bubbles up for you in terms of overcoming that fear and distrust?
So when you go through a traumatic process, your boundaries are violated. That's what happened to us for a long time. That was kind of the root driving idea behind being afraid of things. So we tend to use the strategy of name it, tame it. If you start being triggered, if your affective filters, your emotional filters are activated, we tell people, be aware of that. If you're having a hard time, think about it, talk about it, interact with other people, and you start to understand it a little better. When we first started out, everyone was sure Mark Zuckerberg was going to make $1 million off our language. And I was like, look, first off, if we're using Facebook, it's their data. So just, you got to be careful with what you say. You got to be careful with what you do. Our first network that we did, we had kind of whitelisted, so there was no advertising. It wasn't at soandso.com. It was all very much by us, for us. It was fairly expensive, and we didn't get to do it for long. But that helped people to feel more comfortable. There weren't any logos. There weren't any cookies. There weren't any banner ads. There weren't any of those kind of invasive things that people saw. So when we got to the point of getting them to understand, there are these other platforms you can use. Our community uses Instagram, Twitter, Facebook quite a lot. And we would just tell people, just be careful what you do and how you interact. And understand that there are all of these processes like artificial intelligence, that there are all of these processes like selling ad space the old joke of I started thinking about something and then it was in my feed. People knew then what was happening. It's an algorithm. It looks at all the kinds of things you like and other things you might hear, and your phone's always listening. You know, the old joke of, hey, wiretap, what's a good pancake recipe, right? Your phone is now this access point. So making people aware empowered them, I think, to make better decisions, to not be as afraid. And also, we saw that we had young people talking to their grandparents, too, that were like, hey, grandma, be careful. Don't put that on there. Or be careful with your memes. People are always watching or looking. So even if you have kind of a machine learning algorithm that's looking for keywords and kinds of things, we try to get people to always just think about that. Always understand that there are non-human processes out there that set these filters. The other thing was it helped people to develop protocols. When I go through the process of posting, I have to think about it. There's an internal protocol that you go through that helps you to always remember. Computers could be listening. The AI could be listening. The Terminator could be listening. But the reality is, it helps people kind of develop this set of, this internal voice of what you should and shouldn't say. And so there are some nice things there, that some skills that I don't think we would have had without it, particularly in the context of machine learning and AI and eavesdropping and those kinds of things.
I think you bubbled something up for Ivan, and I was just laughing that I'm pretty sure the Terminator was governor of California for a while, so maybe you have some relevancy there with the situation with PG&E, but please, Ivan.
Well, I also wanted to offer this to you all, because AI has actually been an incredible benefit to you all as the general public, and all of its pluses and minuses. And here's why. When I started my career 28 years ago, I was trained as a computer-assisted reporter. That's what they called it back in those days. They called it data reporting and all these other things now. I'm now sort of the R2-D2 of computer-assisted reporting. But in those days, where journalists in general did not have the kinds of computer researching skills that I had, and some of it wasn't even computer researching as we further developed it, what I had were skills that I could tell you in certain states, depending on what the laws were, how big your house was, how many bedrooms you had in it, how many cars are registered at your address, how many people had driver's licenses at your address, did you have a pool, was it enclosed, your social security number. I didn't need to sit at my computer, I could go to the courthouse, because when you bought your house, your mortgage included your social security number, and so I could get that from the courthouse based on the address that you were living, because it was on your mortgage. From there, if you were a bad guy, I could take your social security number and figure out which state you probably ran to, because the first three digits of your social security number are the state that you got your social security number from. And most bad guys go and run home to mommy after they committed their bad deeds. And so that's how people were found. The bad guys already knew all of this. And it's the bad guys they're the ones who are nefariously taking not just AI, but AI and any other piece of technology or anything that our privacy. We're protecting our privacy we're concerned about the general public having access to our privacy. The ones who really people have to be concerned about are the nefarious ones who have had a variety of accesses to our information for decades. The best part of AI is that now you know that they have had access to all of this stuff. And now you can take an action and participate in a process to beat the dead horse that says, hey, I want you as my representatives to do something.
And as we talk about with politics and policy, 20 years from now is today. And I think certainly with technology moving as quickly, you're bringing to light some truths that a lot of this information has been mined for years. It's just happening at a faster and faster pace. And as we create more and more network infrastructure for that very thing, we're finding that there's a lot of detail, a lot of devils in those details. Christopher, did you have a point?
Oh, I was just going to say I should have said Skynet, which was the underlying AI. Terminator was an agent. So.
I'm sure we have some science fiction fans in the room. Another great question from the audience that I'd like to direct to you, William. Part of what makes us human is our ability to have desire, both good and bad, think, sex, or hunger. How can this be addressed in the consideration of programming in AI? And from your background as a programmer and certainly your exploration of some of these themes in your writing, what guidance can you provide for our audience there?
I'm not sure if this is the direction that you're going to go on this, but to me, one of the things that we have is this pending age of unemployment. And what that really is, I believe the economics of it, we'll figure it out. There's all these things, universal basic income. I'm not going to go into it. I'm not an expert on it. But I believe that fundamentally the issue won't be that we don't have money or we don't have resources, because those are going to become increasingly cheaper. The issue is going to be, what do we want to do with our time, right? If you're a self-actualized person and you have lots of interests and you're in touch with what your purpose is and where you derive pleasure, you're like, great, I'm going to have time and money. I can do all these things, and you're excited by that. But a lot of people don't have that. They haven't reached that point. And the idea of having to derive some sense of identity and self-worth and things to do, and happiness and pleasure and purpose, and not having a job, not having that basic framework that we hang on everything off of, like, that's, to me, the biggest issue. It's not that the jobs go away, it's just what do we do with our time. In the last panel that I was on, we got into a little bit about the ability for AI to be teaching us. And I was saying, you know, universities are very, very expensive. People can't afford them, right? The combination of more knowledge being contributed by more people, crowdsourcing that, using artificial intelligence to find YouTube videos to learn things. You can imagine that we're going to reach some future point where a lot of our education is going to be AI driven. And a lot of that can be focused not on, you know, the basic kinds of education we did in the past, but on how do we find meaning, how do we find purpose, how do we connect with other human beings. Like, these are important things that we need to learn about, and AI can actually help us find that information and teach us. I don't know if that is going in the direction of the question or not.
I think it's helpful. I can build on that. One of our students here on campus asks, how will we know when we have truly created something conscious, rather than a computer that just knows how to imitate a conversation? And I'll open this up to anyone on the panel that wants to dive into really being able to identify what we consider consciousness and not just mimicry or faking its way through a conversation, staying a step ahead. How will we know when we've actually created something on par with ourselves, perhaps, in terms of consciousness?
I don't think that we'll know. We're just not going to know, unfortunately, because the definition of the Turing test is that we can't tell the difference. And so we can never know. We can ask the machine, are you conscious? It will say yes. And we can ask it, you know, what do you think of yourself? And it will give us answers, right? The definition of the Turing test is that it's going to keep giving us answers that we can believe in. How do I know that I'm conscious? How do I know that you're conscious? Right? We just have to sort of trust in it. Or conversely say, it doesn't matter.
So for me, I think There's a threshold in the Turing test. I don't think it's artificially intelligent until it can give you those answers that can trick everyone that listens. If one person is asking a question based on their kind of specific background, education, problem-solving heuristics, their kind of lexical tools, you might be able to fool one person. But if we said, okay, room, the smartest person in the room is this room. Give me the 20 most likely questions that will trip up this AI trying to fool us using a Turing test. Number one, emotional questions about anger, frustration, desire. I think at some point we're going to know when that doesn't really, something is a little bit off there. Ask him, if you've ever been talking to Siri and then swore, you'll know that Siri doesn't really know what to do with it. Is it really, are they verbs? What are the semantics here? I don't understand what you're saying. That's not appropriate, right? So I think at some point, if you have a room, if you increase the sample of people that are asking those questions and listening to these answers that may or may not be able to trick us,
One person doesn't stand a very good chance, but I think the room does. I think the crowd does. I think the crowd will know, hey, I have a background in so-and-so, and I think I heard a hanging exception here. There's something that doesn't quite fit right. Let's focus on that and see where it goes. So the more you have the network knowledge to be able to kind of question and look at that threshold and tell what's happening, I think a group of a very diverse group that asks good questions is going to be able to figure that out. I'm just not sure if it's ever the case that a set of code with preferences programmed in by someone or programmed by itself is going to be able to fool a large body of decision makers.
Do you want to talk? Because I want
to play off both of my colleagues here. And answer it sort of a different way. Baird Anderson said in her keynote earlier today, she was speaking about computers and technology causing us to ourselves to become less empathetic. So some of it is not just a question of AI rising up, but ourselves coming down and actually bringing us to a level where we're lacking empathy, where we're lacking concern, and where we're lacking participation. I mean, we end up giving life and strength to AI because we ourselves become stoic. And that lack of, again, for the third time, participation in the process, many do, but many more don't, because we get lost in everything else that seems more important until we're that family in paradise who lost everything. Then we care. But do we care enough beforehand to make sure that a PG&E doesn't have, again, a tower that's 100 years old when it should have been gone at least a quarter century before?
And I know William has some thoughts as well.
Have you ever talked to somebody who doesn't have a sense of humor at all? It's awkward, right? But they're still human, and they're still intelligent. They just don't have that. And as you were talking about your example, which I think is true, right? Collectively, like, we have a far greater intelligence. We may be putting too strong of a test on an AI to say, well, it's going to respond to every single question in exactly the way a human being would. If that's our test of intelligence, well, it's not really. It's just a test of, are they like us? And we could have an AI that could be intelligent in its own way. It could have its own motivations. It could be aware of its environment, and it could want to change the world and be super intelligent, but then still fail to have certain kinds of intelligence that we have. It may not be emotionally intelligent, or it may not have a sense of humor. So I think we have to be careful, because in some ways, that's the most dangerous space, is where we haven't intelligence, but we don't really understand it. It's so different than us that it's an imperfect understanding, right? And it's kind of likely, actually, that there will be AI that's like that. We still need to find a way to be able to work with it and make sure that it's empathetic to our situation.
I think the decision rule between kind of that narrowly defined and a more strongly defined AI is the idea that if you're able to move outside of a particular realm of knowledge, not just a self-driving car, you can ask a self-driving car what's the quickest way to get to this pizza place. But if you ask it something that's very deep about geopolitics of the Horn of Africa, it's going to be stumped. As a complexity theorist, you're interested in emergent phenomenon where there's not a set of rules to tell you what should happen. That stronger class of AI, I think, has to be able to do that. Here's something that's outside of the realm that I'm thinking. There's not a set of rules to tell me how I should go about this. Do I scrape Wikipedia? Do I data mine what's happening on? Where do I reach to find the information to build a coherent argument for how I should answer something that's completely outside of that realm? So that ability to address the unpredicted or outside of the area, I think is what that differentiation between that strong AI and everything else is. You have to be able to act outside of your normal patterns. You have to be able to do something. So for me, when it comes back to people, that's what's great about people, whether it's one or a whole group. If this group was on the other side of a wall from another group just like you, and we were playing that game back and forth, we could be really good at it, and we would likely play to a checkmate. We'd probably play forever, right? It would be a forfeit. We would never find a way to do that. But as those degrees of freedom go down and we narrow that group from one person trying to trick another or convince another, sooner or later you're going to be called outside of that area that you're familiar with, and that's likely a tell. So I just think it's a really great dynamic between that idea of narrowly defined and stronger, and that's really, I think, what we should all be worried about. When can it answer questions that I would answer that only I could answer? Mm-hmm. How did that get in my feed? I was just thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We're coming up toward the end of time. We still have a little bit for a few questions. I'd like to combine a couple because I think there's some interesting thoughts emerging from the room. And this is again open to all of you on the panel. What practical applications are there for a strong AI in more consumer products and situations? And tacking on another bit of a question, recognizing that there are representations of cultures, economies, where there may not be infrastructure, there may not be representation. What are we losing in developing only in one direction, and what do we need to sustain a more healthy development of AI solutions, be they those narrow-focused AIs or those strong AIs?
Efficiency. I mean, there are a lot of cognitive processes that are really basic. If we know that there's a network of decision makers, whether it's AI or people, and we know that there's certain preferences we have for certain things, for instance, the if you bought this, you might like that type algorithm. I love those. Some of those are really, really helpful. There's an application, and even outside of a particular area, you can buy something on Amazon and find 50 things near like it that you might like. And then you might then go to Amazon Music, and the next thing you know, you're at Apple Music, and you're finding those same kinds of processes. So I think that's an area for that kind of strong AI to reach outside of one area to help make those connections. Again, unfortunately, as a consumer, there's someone making business decisions and selling ad space and those kinds of things. But at least that basic decision-making process for something like that kind of process, I think, is really useful.
William Rodden, thoughts there?
Yeah, I think strong AI is interesting. I think social isolation is a really big issue. 40% of Americans are socially isolated. 60%, if you exclude their romantic partner, they don't have anybody to talk about their day with, talk about their successes, their problems. That's a really big problem. It would sort of seem intuitively like, well, if everyone's isolated, why can't we just talk to the person next to us? And that is its own problem. But the reality is that general AI is going to be a really good way of addressing this, right? Everybody can have their own best friend in the form of an AI who will know exactly what you like and work with you. Strong AI, I think, is going to be really good at teaching people, being able to really customize learning to you and what you're ready for, and giving you individual one-on-one attention. So those are, I think, two of the biggest. I think in the medical field, we already can see that AI is very good at diagnosing situations. We know that AI can control the machinery to do an operation better than a physician in many cases. So we can see the whole medical profession, again, which is also very expensive, right? So the care is unevenly accessible to people. So being able to bring broader care to more people, it's such a complex field that I would be hesitant to say we're going to solve this with narrow AI, because as soon as you get into significant medical issues, it's about talking to the person, coaching their intelligence. So it's really something that's going to be best addressed with strong AI. So those are three really big opportunities.
I think the other thing, too, is choice. You can go to YouTube, and if you want to learn a particular guitar scale or a technique in Pro Tools or something, it gives you what it thinks is most accurate. But then there are thousands of other that branch off, so I can learn things that I wouldn't have even thought of if I would have went to my local guitar center and asked the pro audio guy. He'd have no idea. But you can go to something like the YouTube algorithms, and you can jump very easily, seamlessly from one topic to another and find that situated knowledge.
Anything else? Fair enough. One of the areas, as I was preparing for this session, is the predominant growth of AI machine learning around facial recognition for things like emotional state determination. Are you happy? Are you sad? Are you sleepy? And certainly that's being applied to places like auto safety, which I think is in that narrow AI focus, health screening, and reactions to content. Are you more inclined to go to this movie? Are you laughing at the comedy or at the tragedy? And are you going to be a willing participant in a purchase process? When we think about those consumer-focused applications and the incorporation of our identity into that process, do any of you have concerns about that increasing awareness of how we show up in these systems and how those data points are then leveraged as we develop some of these emerging technologies?
Well, I mean, obviously, the big concern is how where that information ends up and how it gets used. And as I said before, a lot of the people we have the greatest concern about having that information, a lot of them have ways to get it, and so the only. You know, I try to say it a fourth different way, but a large part of the reality is that there is just so much of this that is in the hands of the people if the people believe it. I think we're clear that yeah, this thing could go to a place where AI could replace us. I mean, it could. And that obviously is a concern. It has the great benefit of being able to help us do things more efficiently, faster, and save lives. I mean, without a question. But in the end, it's already been said, the collective intellect in the room, more or less, you know, across our country, around the globe, is far greater right now. But it requires us to care. I mean, it's the irony of this whole thing. We're concerned about how much AI will get to the place where it is like us, but we are not being the very thing that we're concerned of AI becoming. I mean, that's the whole irony of all of it.
I'll leave it there.
So to me, one of the things, and I'll kind of close off with this idea with respect to the self-driving cars and whatnot. At some point, we're all really skeptical of the CEOs that say, here's the balance sheet, here's the profit margin, here are the constraints. We feel like that's unhuman to us at times. But now imagine you're a self-driving car and it's hit this pedestrian or that pedestrian. At some point, someone programs those. So even though there may have only been a couple of fatalities with self-driving cars, there's only a few self-driving cars out there. If we replace every single car in the country with self-driving cars, who knows how that scaling is going to work? It's going to stumble and fall just like human beings taking on the automobiles, the primary mode of transportation, have stumbled and fallen as well. So.
Yeah, going back to the original example, AI was used to analyze calls to suicide hotlines. And one of the things they were able to do was identify the keywords that predicted the people who were most at risk and be able to move those people to the front of the queue for help. And so this has been a tremendous difference. And so like the example of being able to go beyond that to the visual realm, right, is even better because now we have even more cues that we can use to be able to help the people most at risk. So that's wonderful. At the same point in time, from the privacy side of this, it's people in society, we have people looking to participate in subcultures because they're safe in the subcultures. Right, a queer person feels safe with other queer people. They may not be out at work. And they're, people are increasingly drawn to these cultures where they're safe. And the problem with a lot of this stuff is the cross-pollination, right? I want to participate in this subculture. I don't want my membership and everything I've done and all my content here to become visible over there, but AI algorithms are going to match it all up based upon visual stuff and based upon patterns and communication. So people are going to be outed increasingly through AI. That's, you know, not a good thing. But so it's like all of these things, they're going to have the good, they're going to have the bad. I don't know if I already said this, that we do a whole lot of investment in developing AI. Like, AI development investment is way up here. The amount that's done into risk mitigation and safety and control and measures, it's down here. It's like barely even on the table. And we could do a whole lot just by increasing it more, just saying, you know, for every $100 we're putting into AI development, let's spend $5 on safety and controls and mitigation and social issues. I think that would go a long way.
I think that dovetails a bit into what Ivan shared as well, looking at corporate responsibilities, some liabilities and opportunities we have now. And William, I think you gave us a little taste of Killswitch. There's some topics from your book that I recognize, so thank you for introducing that. I'm going to close out with this question, and William, building on your work as an author, William Gibson's Sprawl trilogy definitely shaped a lot of my young computer hacker days. And that was a lot about the rise of AI, both in terms of corporate systems of ownership and dominance, and how that dovetails into government. And I saved a question from our audience that I like, that I'll put to all of you briefly. Who will develop the first strong AI, a corporation or a government? Will we know when it happens, and if so, how?
I think it's going to be a young person somewhere that's not really either one of them. I think AI will learn like humans learn, and if we were to say, will the next president be a corporate entity, or will it be someone from, I don't know, I think it will come from somewhere that are least likely to expect. I'm sure as a young hacker, you probably were not one from either of those groups.
I think the first is likely to come from a corporation just because they have access to the resources to do it. But the exponential growth in computing power means that whatever is accessible to the world's richest corporation today will be accessible to a hobbyist 10 years later. So the first AI may come from some computing lab in a corporate giant, but 10 years later, it's going to be coming from every hobbyist in their garage.
If you know the answer, please get it to me so I can write a story.
Well said. Let's give that applause.